Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang tammang sanghang namassami. Tonight, at least partly, I'm going to talk about this water. And it just so happens that the water monk brought me some water. So, believe that's a position of great merit. Lungpor Liam has spoken in praise of that whoever looks after water systems as being monks who have great merit, and also the Buddha praised it, I believe, in the Sutta Nipata. So there's actions of body, speech, and mind. The word for action in Pali is kama, in Sanskrit karma. It means action. And there's unwholesome and wholesome actions of body, there's wholesome and unwholesome actions of speech, and there's wholesome and unwholesome acts of the mind. So wholesome and unwholesome thoughts and intentions. And in general, in society, there tends to be an undercurrent of negativity. And so when we come to Dhamma practice, we attempt to go against the stream of society and try to do what we can to cultivate the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome and keep a positive state of mind, a state of mind that's not overly critical of oneself or others, and finding doing what we can, taking on various practices and contemplations and reflections in order to try to stay positive. Because if we think about it, the odds are against us, and it really takes a shift in our views and our way of thinking in order to cultivate the wholesome and abandon the unwholesome. Lungpor Liam, when he was here, talked about ditu jukhama, which is dit is like ditti or views, like sammaditti, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, means right view. So dit is like a ditti. Uju is straight or upright. Like ujjupatipanno, those who practice directly, those who practice uprightly, those who practice straightforwardly. So uju is straight, or like in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Buddha says that the meditator sits up straight, so he sits up uju. And then kamma, action or doing, as in the Pali word kammatthana, which means basis for practice or basis for action. So ditujju kamma is to straighten one's views, or the practice of straightening one's views, so that they're in line with Dhamma. And this is something which is necessary for cultivating the wholesome, abandoning the unwholesome. And now the way this ties in with water is, it's a good reflection to think of where the water comes from. And in this monastery, we have a couple of water sources. We have a well up on our ridge, about roughly 1,000 feet higher than where we're sitting right now. And we also have a spring across the street on a different property, that this land has an easement to that spring. So we have a couple of water sources. And it's good to not take the water that we have for granted. It's amazing to me that this well up on the ridge has produced so much water for us. We had a few instances in the early days of attempts at digging wells and pumping out from wells. We had First, there was a well by the exit down here, which was a it was meant to be a temporary source, and it barely produced anything. Then there was a well that we dug up at the ordination platform, at the clearing up there. And we had to use a generator to pump the water out of that well. And once you pumped out about 600 gallons, it would run dry. So we had to really regulate. Anyone who was looking after the water system at that time, it was a constant chore just trying to get water out of that well. And then one day, it just stopped and the well just caved in. And so we had also dug the well on the ridge early on. I think it was 1998 even, 1998, 1999. This well was dug up on the ridge, but it was just capped and it was very, very far away. So nobody had thought of really tapping into it, sinking a pump down into it. But it was there. So eventually we decided to go for it and do a big water system project where we tapped into that well. We sunk a pump down in there, tested it. It had very clean, cold, pure water coming out. Didn't seem like it was going to run dry, so we ran a couple miles of water line, and we get water from that well. Water from our spring across the street services just the cloister area here, whereas water from our well services the rest of the monastery. So you can't exist, can't live without water. And it's important to cultivate a sense of gratitude, because that's really the root of most of our wholesome qualities, is a sense of gratitude. And so when we turn on the shower, we can give rise to a sense of gratitude. Where does that water come from? It doesn't just come from the shower head, it comes from the earth. It comes from deep in that well, deep in the earth. And somehow, some way, that well hasn't gone dry. The water's been regenerating. So when we turn on the shower, we can have a wholesome mental state there, a sense of gratitude for the water that we have. When we drink water here, we can have a sense of gratitude for the water we're able to drink. We can have a sense of gratitude and a sense of thankfulness for the water that we have, because without that water, you wouldn't be listening to a Dhamma talk tonight. We wouldn't have anything. We wouldn't have the monastery. We couldn't live here without water. If our water sources somehow dried up, then perhaps we could rely on water trucks for a little while, but there's no way we could do that long term. So in this time, in this place, the water that we have gives rise to everything that we have here, everything good that we have. So this is important, because if the mind is tending towards negativity, then we might turn on the water to get a drink of water, and yet we might be proliferating or thinking about some sort of what somebody said to us, or some sort of petty issue. Or we might be proliferating about some sort of work task or administrative duty that needs to be done. Or we might be just daydreaming. And yet when we turn on the tap and get a drink of water, we can cut through all that proliferation and just reflect that this water comes from a well deep in the earth. And without this water, then I wouldn't be able to quench my thirst. I wouldn't be able to have that pleasant sensation right now associated with being thirsty and having a drink of water, just something that simple, just to keep our life going. How often is the mind somewhere else? It's not present with what we're actually experiencing. It just comes back to mindfulness. Mindfulness, clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, just being with what we're experiencing. It's not necessary to think, am I going to get something from my practice? Am I going to be enlightened in the future? how are things going to be for me in the future? How am I going to get the things that I want in the future? Or rather, we just come back to the present moment, the practice here and now. So the water comes from deep in the earth. We don't know why that well keeps going. We don't know why our spring across the road keeps going. There's forces in the earth, or we don't even know what forces keep that water flowing to us. But maybe it's a good practice to try out when you get up in the morning, face towards the ridge and give thanks, face towards the other side of the valley, give thanks for the water. We were doing that well development project in 2004, and Lungpur Liam came to visit, and I was doing a few things on that project and kind of suffering a lot over it. And I remember asking Lungpur Liam, if you take on a work project or you do some sort of service for the community and you just suffer a lot over it, is it good? Is it wholesome? And he said that it is, that especially doing work on a water system, that's the kind of merit that keeps flowing to you. And he referred to it as mahadana. It's a great act of generosity, great act of service. In most monasteries I've visited in Thailand, there's a monk who looks after the water system. So, yeah, here too, we have someone looking after the water system, and so that's a act of great merit, great sacrifice. It's a lot of work, but I think bears great fruit. So a couple of themes Lungpur Liam has been teaching as of late. I was talking to Ajahn Taneo, Lungpur Liam's translator, Australian monk who was here with him, and asking what is Lungpur Liam teaching these days, because he'll usually have some sort of theme that he's teaching on at Wat Pa Phong. And Ajahn Taneo mentioned there's a couple themes that Lungpur Liam has been expounding on again and again. And one of the themes is the difference between a worldly person and a person who's transcended the world. And that was one theme. And another theme was the practice of offering victory to others and taking the defeat upon oneself. So this practice of transcending the world, it's good to reflect that the Dhamma practice leads away from the world and it leads to a transcendence of the world. So there actually is a different way of being. There actually is a different way of thinking. Dituju kama is a different way of thinking, a straight way of thinking, and a way of living which transcends the world. One thing Lungpur Liam has been teaching on along those lines is that one who transcends the world no longer thinks in terms of gain and loss. So one who has not transcended the world, the thinking is always in terms of gain and loss. And one who has transcended the world no longer thinks in terms of gain and loss. And they tend to think more in terms of what is going to be of benefit. So this is a paradigm shift, which can be difficult to understand. When we think in terms of gain and loss, or what we call the worldly way of thinking, that's going to be in terms of a sense of self that's built up over a lifetime, a sort of edifice of self. What can I get? How can I get it? What do I have now? How can I protect it? How can I not lose it? How can I shift and adjust my living situation to be more amenable to me, How can I keep from losing my money, losing whatever status I might have? And this doesn't just happen in the world, it happens in the monastery. It's talking about the world, it's not outside of the monastery, but the world is our body and mind, whether we're monks or lay people. So this applies to everybody. How can I get people to think better of me and not worse of me? How can I become more popular? How can I gain popularity? How can I get more pleasure? How can I eke out a little corner, a good little corner for myself? It's good to see the stress and tension that comes from that way of thinking. It's not freedom. It's a self-created prison, like a self-created prison cell. Self is a prison cell. The sense of self is a prison cell. Prison self. Prison cell. And the Buddha said that his teachings have only one taste, the taste of freedom. And so if there's that tension, that stress, that's not freedom. That's something where we're confined to a very small and narrow space. So one practice to sort of get out of that small, narrow viewpoint is just metta practice. So metta can be very freeing, because normally the mind is tending towards a bit of tension, a bit of being critical towards oneself and others, critical towards maybe a certain situation, or longing for a situation that we don't have. And with metta, which is goodwill, we start by having goodwill for ourselves, and that spreads out naturally and becomes goodwill for others. And not just goodwill, but having a sense of, how would you say, maybe compassion for oneself, but also like throw oneself a bone, or giving oneself a break, maybe. So that sense of giving oneself permission to not have to think about the past or the future, not have to proliferate about if one is good enough or one has a good enough reputation, or not have to proliferate about gain and loss, at least temporarily, just to try it out. Try it out in the meditation. Giving a gift to oneself, doing an act of kindness for oneself, allowing the burden just to lift, at least temporarily. And in the moment, if we're looking at our experience here and now and not proliferating about a past experience or hoping for some future experience, if we're just in the experience here and now, then that's a real act of kindness to ourselves. And so we feel the burden lift. Perhaps a sense of joy will arise along with that. And as that burden lifts, then there's a sense of freedom. So we're getting closer to the Dhamma there. The more there's a sense of freedom, closer we are to the Dhamma, the closer we are to a state which is free of gain and loss. And it's great peace, great joy accompanies that. We might think, why did I ever think like that before? Why? We'll look back and think, why did I ever think in terms of gain and loss? But then the old habits come up again, the mind goes back. So we have to practice this again and again. Then there's that practice of offering victory to others, taking the defeat upon oneself. This is a practice which generates communal harmony. It's also compassion. Usually when two people are having some sort of a conflict or an argument, then there's tension and stress and suffering on both sides. And normally the worldly way of reacting to somebody else's stress or suffering is to either get irritated or angry at their suffering, to get irritated or angry at their anger. The Buddha said that anger is never vanquished by more anger. Irritation is never vanquished by more irritation. Only by goodwill, loving kindness, is anger able to be vanquished or done away with. Normally the way of the world is, well, somebody's killing somebody, so let's kill them. Or there's a possibility this group of people might kill that group of people, so we'll kill this group of people. And that just really just keeps the cycle going. You can't get rid of negative energy by adding more negative energy. It's only that positivity which will cause it to disappear quite quickly. So this offering victory to others and the defeat upon oneself. Say there's some sort of difference of views, or it may be a major disagreement, or it could even be a minor disagreement. But the moment that one of the people then has that flip take place in the mind where they give up on their own viewpoint and then make a very conscious decision to let go as an offering to the other person in order to make them feel good. It's not like, okay, you win, fine. You know, it's not like that, but just really being able to do it in a way that empowers the other person and gives them a very genuine victory, and then to be able to let go of one's own viewpoint. That's what we call humility. That's a very important quality to be cultivating in the Dhamma practice. Of course, then if you get a group of people who have that kind of a quality, you get this incredible sense of harmony. So this is also a very mature and noble way to take responsibility for one's own actions and mental states. It's noble because when we take responsibility in this way, then we're actually changing the only thing we really can change, which is ourselves. We can't go about changing other people. We can train the mind, we can straighten out these views or let go. We can be free, but we can't force anyone else to be free. It has to be their own practice. We can do that ourselves. There's also the way we tend to misunderstand each other. So a lot of, actually all conflicts come from misunderstanding, or what we call ignorance, not seeing clearly, avijja. And so when we come back to this noble quality of taking a sense of loss or defeat on ourselves, then what we're doing here is we're taking responsibility for our own actions to the point of we train ourselves in a sense of training oneself. And when we think of the way people misunderstand each other, so you hear it so often, they misunderstand me, or this person misunderstands me, or that group doesn't understand me. And that's a very common thing that you hear. This person misunderstands me, that person misunderstands me. But then the more noble standpoint is taking that on oneself. Well, maybe it's me who misunderstands them. Maybe I'm the one who's misunderstanding. Even if it really seems like they're the ones who misunderstand, then really just trying it out, just using that phrase, even if you don't really mean it at first, just maybe I'm the one who misunderstands. And that's a very noble viewpoint, because it really causes one to reflect deeply on a more subtle and profound level on one's own actions of body, speech, and mind. And this isn't really, it can't be done in a sense of ridiculing oneself or being overly critical of oneself, but it's a very sober and reflective way of being, very mature. And pushing ourselves with that reflection in order to look deeper, that's going to help us get closer to the Dhamma, help us to free ourselves. If we're always thinking other people misunderstand us, then how are we ever going to change ourselves? How are we ever going to adjust whatever habits are causing stress and tension for ourselves, if it's always coming from outside? Actually, none of it's coming from outside. It's all coming from inside. It's all coming from the heart. There's lots of stories of these great Ajahns in Thailand. There's like the story of when Lungpa Sumedho went with Lungpa Cha to, actually no, it was just, I think it was Lungpa Sumedho, went to pay respects to Lungpu Khao, who was on his deathbed, a very senior disciple of Ajahn Mun. Lungpu Khao. And Ajahn Sumedho relating that Lungpu Khao's eyes were just bright, and he was just beaming, just radiant, on his deathbed, just some horrible illness, completely emaciated, but he was just really just glowing, just radiating. And Lungpu Khao saying, like, it's here, it's just here, it's all here, and he's pointing to his heart. It's all here in the heart. Or there's another story of Ajahn Mahabua was on Tudong with another monk. And this other monk was senior to Ajahn Mahabua, was taking him on Tudong. And Ajahn Mahabua said, stop, I'm going to go. I have to go use the bushes, I have to urinate. And so he stopped. Let me know if someone comes. And so the other monks, oh, okay. And they're on kind of a public trail. They'll let me know if someone comes. And so he's off, and then the other monk is like, there's someone here. And so he's, what? And so he gets up, and he's pointing to Ajahn Mahabua. There's someone there. And then he goes up and points at his heart. There's someone there, in there. So it's always good to start to get into the habit as practitioners. It's difficult because it's a paradigm shift, shifting out of our regular ways of being or relating to the world and to each other. But it's incredibly wholesome. And it's a way of abandoning the unwholesome actions of body, speech, and mind, cultivating wholesome habits. And it doesn't mean we're overly passive with each other, but also it means that this is something we can do to fully harmonize with one another. It's really important to have examples too, like just our senior monks, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Pasano, and of course Lungpur Liam and others, just to set an example of how one can be in a, how one can relate to others and to the world in a way that's fully wholesome and harmonious. There's a story in the Visuddhimagga of a monk who is a Tudong monk, but he's spending the rains retreat in a hut near a village. And so he spends the rains retreat there. He's been meditating, practicing through the rains retreat for 3 months. And villagers have been supporting him, and then he decides he's going to leave after the rains retreat and continue his wandering. And the lay people come to him and they say, "Please don't leave, please don't leave." And he's saying, "Why?" And they said, "Well, as soon as you came, we stopped bickering and fighting with each other so much. And we've been living harmoniously together for this 3 months. And now if you leave, we're afraid we're going to start bickering and fighting with each other again." So even just having that influence, I think that's what that story shows, even just having that influence on others is important. And that bhikkhu wasn't doing anything special. He was looking after his own practice. He could have been, we don't even know what he was practicing. He could have been practicing loving kindness, or he could have just been in deep states of meditation, and so loving kindness would have been naturally radiating out. He would have been going on alms round in that village. So people get to see his calm demeanor and get inspired by that. People may have been harmonizing with each other in terms of giving food to that monk, pooling their resources, getting together, looking after him. In the end, it really comes back to what can we find that we can be grateful for in order to brighten the mind, inspire the mind, make the mind more wholesome. There's a Native American saying, when you wake up in the morning, be thankful for the air that you breathe. Be thankful that it's clean and pure. Be thankful for the water that you drink. Be thankful for the sun, that it warms the earth, that you can just feel the sun on your face. Be thankful for your friends and relatives, teachers. If you can't find anything to be thankful for, the fault lies with yourself. I think a lot of times if we get sad or depressed, it is because we can't find anything to be thankful for. The mind has gone a bit dark or a bit dim. So just that directing the mind to things to be thankful for is a way of brightening the mind, inspiring the mind, being able to face the next day, whatever it may bring. It can happen if, like as a monk, if you're a monk for a long time, or if you're, I would think, as a layperson, as a lay practitioner for a long time, there might be some sort of good meditation experience in the beginning, or there's a deep sense of bliss or inspiration, but then as time goes on, perhaps things stagnate, or the practice gets a bit boring, or things don't seem to be going anywhere. And so these kinds of reflections about, for example, the reflection on water, not taking the water for granted, the water that we shower with, the water that we drink, these are things which can bring us back to the present moment. So after we've been practicing for a long time, thinking that we have to make our practice more like the earth, we have to be just patient. Just cultivate that sense of gratitude and thankfulness each day. We'll start to be able to sustain ourselves in a way that's more long-term. So we're not searching for exciting peak experiences. And it's not about just bludgeoning ourselves until we somehow, I don't know, just like till the sense of self just dies. But it's about just steadily training oneself to cultivate the wholesome, abandon the unwholesome. And even though the odds are against us, we have these practices from the Buddha, from our Ajahns, and really picking them up, really cultivating a sense of desire, a sense of desire to experience freedom, abandoning the unwholesome. So just mindfulness, just coming back to the present moment. And if one loses the plot or gets distracted or noticing one is daydreaming, or it's important to come back, what can we be grateful for? All the things, just list all the things one can be grateful for. There's a teaching of Sariputta in the suttas where he's teaching the monks to cultivate exclusively the positive. And in the sutta, it's in relation to other people. And so Sariputta said that for a practitioner, one is only to focus on the positive attributes of other people and to disregard the negative attributes. So he said if someone has half good qualities and half bad qualities, one is to focus exclusively on that person's good qualities. If one has mostly bad qualities and only some good qualities, one is to focus on those some good qualities and not to pay attention to the bad qualities. And if one has only a few good qualities and mostly bad qualities, but there is some goodness there that you can find, then you're supposed to, just as a thirsty man would, during a drought, would find a cow's hoof print filled with water, and if he was careful, he could cup his hands in the water and allow the silt to go through his fingers, and he could get clean enough water to drink. So too, if someone has almost completely bad qualities, but only a few hard-to-see good qualities, just like that thirsty man drinking water out of the hoof print, one is to focus exclusively on that person's good qualities. And then if someone is a complete maniac and killer and whatever, one is to not associate with them. So you know, if your friend is like Mao Zedong or something, then don't associate with that person. Just run away, get away. But this is a good teaching because it shows us that it kind of goes against that thinking of attacking someone else's bad qualities and thinking that that's going to get rid of them. Or rather, this is a teaching of finding one's good qualities and seeing that that's where we can work, that's where we can make an inroad. So be thankful for the water, being thankful for the earth, thankful for the air that we can breathe, and cultivating the wholesome, abandoning the unwholesome. I think that's enough tonight.
Sadhu. Sadhana.